Good morning. How is everybody? Excellent. Well, I'm here this morning to talk to you about God's faithfulness. I don't know about you, but when I ask for specific direction from God, I have a really tough time discerning His will over my will. I don't know if I just don't slow down enough or it's just, I don't know what it is. I don't hear very well, unfortunately. Well, I wanted to go to Mexico this year, so I began praying in January because I know this about myself. So in January, I start praying over and over and over every day. And then about mid-March, as I'm getting ready for church on a Sunday morning, I hear, "You're going to Mexico, you better get busy." Like, what was that? Okay. So of course, who do I see when I walk in the door but Patty Cormack? Race up to her, I'm going to Mexico this year, and I fill out the application right away. And then what? Oh my gosh, what did I just do? Why did I say that? How can I commit to that? I have no resources. What am I doing? And then other things came up. I was able to put that out of my head for a little while, and then it comes up again, and I'm like, how can you do this? You don't have the time. You don't have the resources. It's impossible. You know, just backpedaling. I need to just tell Patty I can't go and be done with it. And during that time, I just continued to pray, okay, God, if you say I'm going, let me know. And then I heard it again. You're going to Mexico. You better get busy. So with a ton of encouragement from friends, I threw out my fleece in the form of a fundraising letter to about a dozen people. It was pretty overwhelming. In 15 minutes, I got my first response in email saying, yes, I want to help you. Over the next few weeks, every time somebody brought an offering to me, I would literally cry. People I didn't even send the letter to were calling me saying, I want to help you. It was overwhelming how God showed His faithfulness to me. And I'm still amazed how God can make the undoable done. This is just one of the ways that God has shown His faithfulness to me over the past 3 years. So when you hear something and you're not sure if it's you or not, I encourage you to listen. And if it seems uncomfortable, it's probably God saying, do it. So it might be Him just wanting to bless you, show you how faithful He is. Thank you.
Our first scripture reading for today is from the book of Genesis, chapter 8, verses 20 to 22. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease." Our second reading is from the book of Genesis, chapter 9, verses 12 through 16. And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. You may be seated.
Thanks, Mike. So it was during the Bronze Age, as the story goes, that Zeus became so frustrated with humanity that he decided to send a flood. Prometheus became aware of this, and he kind of gave the information to his son, Deucalion, and said, hey, you got to be prepared for this. He told him to build a little chest, and so the floodwaters came, ravaging through the hills and filling up the earth around, and Deucalion and his wife, Pyrrha, climbed into this little chest for 9 days and kind of floated around on the top until they reached the top of Mount Parnassus, and then they finally got back out. When they did, they had this offering they made to Zeus out of thankfulness for kind of saving them through the midst of that. We deal with a lot of stories in this setting on Sunday mornings, right? We come back and the Bible is filled with a ton. This story for today is a really unique one. And I want you just to be able to kind of pause and recognize that, right? We obviously deal with some pretty old stories. We have new ones, like what Frankie had to share. But a lot of the stuff that we read biblically is stuff that happened 2,000 or more years ago. The story that we look at today, though, is actually the oldest written story that humanity knows. There's this really ancient text over 5,000 years old. Oldest thing that we have written anywhere, called the Epic of Gilgamesh. It was written in Babylon, and it describes, again, the flood. The Greek story of Zeus describes, that the biblical story of Noah describes. So this is an ancient story, but it also is an incredibly widespread one. Right? Most of the stories that we interact with that are listed on that scroll over there are largely Christian or Jewish stories. Right, they're not referenced in a lot of other places. The kingdoms they talk about it are, they're rooted in history, etc., etc., etc. But we don't find a lot of stories about Joseph written in other cultures, right? We don't find stories of Moses written in other cultures. We don't find stories of Peter or Paul written in other cultures. Even Jesus, pretty limited in where those extent is until you get his followers much later on. That is not true about the flood. There are literally hundreds upon hundreds of different cultures that are spread over every inch of this planet that have a flood story connected to them. Right? So just drink that in for a moment. This is not a microcosm of Middle Eastern cultures that had some flood that's kind of localized there. You go all over Africa, North Africa to South, East to West, you find the flood stories. You go through Europe, you find them. As far north as Scandinavia, you travel through the cultures of North and South America. The Aztecs, the Incans, etc., have their own flood stories. You go to islands in the middle of the Pacific, separated from anyone else around, and they have stories of this flood. You find them in Asia. There's not a continent, not even a section of humanity, of the scope of this planet, where there are not stories of this flood. And the stories have an amazing similarity about them. We're used to some general kind of categories of stories that exist out there, but the stories that we hear about this, hundreds of them have these things in common. I'll give you a list of 14. You can write any of them down you want if you want. The first 10, though, all have over 50% agreement. So you just got to pause for a moment and realize here is a universal human story. Right, it is the only, apart from how we began, the only truly universal human story. Every other story that we have, be it from the Bible or any other religious text or your own life, deals with only a segment of humanity. It is only the story of the flood that touches every single living person on the planet at any given time. So maybe because of that, that's the reason why it's one of those stories that has resonated around the globe since then. Here is the congruence among those stories. The catastrophe is only a flood, so not connected to a fire, not connected to a war, not connected to anything else, 95%. The flood is global. And it's not a local flood. It's not just, hey, this was just around us right now. But it's around the entire world. 95% of the stories in all of these cultures resonate with that truth. There is a favored family that is rescued, and they are the only ones to make it through. 88% of those stories, from the Pacific Islands to northern Russia to Egyptians to Indians and Hindu writings from ages past, all reflect the same kind of thing. The geography has a local connotation to it. So there's a connection to real kind of people and events around there. Animals play a part in the story. They're connected in there. 73% survival by a boat, 70% of them. Animals are saved on the boat, 67%, over two-thirds. Have that same truthful or that same aspect tied into that. They were forewarned, 66%. The flood is due to the wickedness of men. Again, 66% of the stories, that same truth kind of rooted in there, that same idea rooted in there. The survivors land on a mountain and get out, 57%. Birds are sent out to find out if the waters have receded enough, 35% of the stories. The survivors offer a sacrifice, 13%. Eight people. It's a really specific detail. 9% of the stories. And again, not all localized in one certain area, spread around the globe. Eight people saved out of that. The rainbow's mentioned 7% of the time. Out of hundreds of stories, that's vastly more than just the biblical story that references that rainbows are a connecting point to what this flood is and some promise coming out of that. I realize that as we deal with stories from the Bible, especially ones of this kind of nature, that it's easy to wrestle with this is a question, is this like myth? Designed to teach some general truths, but not an actual kind of reality that occurred to us? Or is it something that really happened? Obviously, a place of faith for you on your own to figure out. When I hear these kinds of statistics, though, I think it lends a lot of credence to the idea that something happened globally. In our past as a humanity, for it to be rooted in that many different cultures and have that much agreement on things, I think you can begin to have a confidence that there is this event that's rooted in our human history that speaks deeply to us. If it's just a myth, then it may or may not be true. But if it's really true, then there is a God of immense power and a God who's going to reveal his heart to us in this time. So regardless of where you come from on that, I just want to invite you, at least for the message, to go ahead and step into a place of saying, all right, what if this is really true? What if this really did impact the world, and this is how it happened, and see how God might reveal himself to you in that way? So I want to invite you to close your eyes right now and just kind of come to God. We come to the God that we kind of know individually, but I want to invite you to come to the God of the flood today. Just to kind of center and be aware that this God who did bring this destructive force on our earth and rescue some out of it is the same God that you are connecting to today. Just to be present in his midst this morning. So our last week on Genesis, we started off largely happy, I think. I mean, we get to see the world come into order. We get to see relationships develop and gender. And it's all these kind of good things bubbling through and celebrate the goodness that comes into our life in all of those categories. And then we've taken a really downward trend in the last couple weeks, just being honest with you. It seems like all we've talked about is the consequences of sin. Which honestly, from Genesis 3 on, is kind of where the rest of the Bible and human history goes. And we've looked at all of these aspects of what sin does. Right, we've examined that sin brings shame, which is this relational brokenness that we have. We looked at the consequences of us being at war with Satan, of the brokenness in our human relationships, of wanting power over each other and fighting and wrestling over that, the pain that comes in childbirth, the pain that comes in our human relationships, the pain that comes out of having to work hard, death that comes into our lives because of that, right? We examined even last week the battles that come between siblings, God's call for us to be responsible for other people and our desire to be isolated from that. So in all these areas, we've looked at how sin impacts our lives. We have one more today, which is kind of unique. But then once we're done with that, really we have the foundation of sin set for the rest of the Bible. Everything else that we'll see after that are merely reflections of these kind of aspects of sin. And we'll see them repeated again. We'll see them emphasized again. But really, all of them are just reflecting what God has already revealed to us. The last area of sin, the last way that it impacts, is a unique one for us, though. All of the first ones are really kind of in our wheelhouse because they're the ones that we personally are engaged in. We all understand those. If you're a woman and you've given birth, you can raise your hand and say, it is painful, right? If you ever worked a day in your life, you can say, I know that it's hard work, right? It's not easy, right? All of us can say, I know people have died. I know they've passed away. I know death is a reality in our relationship. We can all raise our hand and say, I've experienced shame. I know broken relationships. I know a hunger to have power over others and them to have power over me. We all resonate and connect to those, right? This last one, though, is outside of us. It's not an impact in our own lives, it's an impact in God. And so we get stuck on ourselves most of the time. We're naturally self-centered people, so we resonate and look at that deeply. But for today, we need to take our eyes off of ourselves for a little bit and realize that sin also touches God. He is not isolated from sin as though he's in some kind of holy bubble off in wherever place it is that God exists. And he's set the order in place down here. And when sin happens, he's like, well, that's too bad for you. Here's the consequences. But I am separate from that, right? That's not the image that we have. If we look in Genesis chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, and we'll kind of pick up our speed and get into verse 6 in a moment. It says that God saw how great man's wickedness on earth had become. That every inclination on the thoughts of men and women, the thoughts of the heart, was only evil all the time. And so in verse 6 then, we see that God has a personal response to that. It's not just, hey, you broke the law, this is a consequence, isolated kind of love and logic. Like, that's the kind of parenting model that I've been encouraged to have, right? I'm not emotionally connected to that. You broke the rule, here's a consequence, there it is. God doesn't really practice that, at least according to Genesis 6. He's all in on this. And so it says in Genesis 6, as God responds to that personally, that the Lord was grieved, right? His heart was rent that he had even made humanity and put them on the earth. And why did he grieve that decision? Why did he say, I'm weeping, I'm agonizing over this? Because his heart was filled with what? What does it say at the end of verse 6? Right, we have to reset our theology a little bit, because in every other religion around the world, God is isolated from pain. God doesn't feel pain. God doesn't suffer, right? God is perfect. He's whole. He's complete in all these categories. And so now we have, from our Christian understanding, this unique understanding of a God who isn't just separated out from us, but somehow gets so involved in the midst of where we are that he suffers. There is real pain that God experiences when we sin. And most of the time, if you're anything like me, when we engage with confession or dealing with the sin in our own life, we pay a lot of attention to how it affects us. I'm uncomfortable. We have a tense relationship. Now I need to resolve it. That's usually what drives us to confession, right? We pay a little bit of attention to how it impacts others. Right, as parents, we can all identify one of our challenges is, can I help you recognize how what you're doing impacts another person? Right, that's just a challenge as parents. Can you step into their own experience and realize how those words made them feel, how they experienced that, right? But that's not just on a parenting role. That's really the rest of our lives. Like, being able to step back and realize that what I did or said or what I left undone had an impact on another person. And so in our best moments of confession, we get to that. And then rarely, if ever, though, do we pause and say, God, did this impact you? But here is what Genesis 6 is saying, is that it does. And not only the sins that they did back then, but the sins that you have committed have brought pain to the heart of God. I want to take a moment in the sermon right now just to pause for confession. So we can just kind of have this new experience about that. We've done that a lot. Pattern is probably familiar to you, right? We'll give you a little period of quiet. You can just let the Holy Spirit search over your last week and say, hey, where are there things that I'm ashamed of? Where are there relationships that are broken? Where was I selfish in my actions and my choices? I'm kind of laying those before God. And then as you do that, I just want to invite you to just communicate back to Him, I know that this brought pain to you. It might have been between me and another human being, but I know it brought pain into your existence. Pain that you can feel, that you can experience, that resonates in your heart. Okay? So now we're going quiet, confess, and just understand the impact it has for God. To be fairly provincial people that often don't look up much than our own existence. As we look at failures in our life, we do need to see how they impact others. We do need to see how they impact you. God, everything that we've laid before you is wrong. But at the core of all of it is this pain that it causes to you as our Creator. We acknowledge that before you. I don't have an answer, and I have a way to fix it. What is really amazing to me is that your solution to that, your solution to this pain that rests on your heart, is a pain that you put into your body on a cross. And so, God, we brought you pain in our sin, and we bring you pain and the forgiveness you bring to us. So you are doubly pained by us. And we are doubly freed by you, doubly blessed by you, doubly graced by you. It is not fair, but it is profoundly good. And we thank you for that. So this experience of God is really important as we look at what flows afterward. It's a good metaphor, right? Because the water is going to flow. And it's easy as we look at that just to get this sense of this highly judgmental God without recognizing that it's at his heart, right? There's this place, the reason he moves into a situation of a highly destructive flood is because he says, I can't live with this pain. Something has to change. Right? This is what is written on God's heart, and he responds by saying, I need to have a response to this evil that is everywhere around me. And I need to respond to that. This is a righteous response of God. There is evil, and evil is to be punished, so God's response to that isn't wrong. What's interesting, though, is that most of what we pay attention to on the flood is this focus on judgment. As though that's the core nature of the whole story. That's what God is about and what we need to learn from and grab from the story. I think we're missing it when we do that. We read from Genesis 6, right? God saying, hey, every inclination of their heart is evil, so I got to bring a flood. And we tend to have this assumption then that the flood is there to fix wickedness. It's not. Right? The flood is there to punish it. And it punished the wickedness that was present in the world of that day, but it didn't fix it. Look in chapter 8, and we have this reading. Mike read this for us, right? So right when it's over, in verse 20, Noah's finally on dry ground again, right? He's not in the wavy boat anymore. He's on solid ground. He's walking around. He builds an altar to God. He takes some of the animals and offers sacrifices on it. God is pleased by that. God responds and says, never again will I curse the ground because of man. Right? Even though... And what does he say right afterwards, in verse 21? Even though every inclination of his heart is what? Evil. So the same thing it was right before the flood. God brought the flood because he said every inclination of your heart is evil. And when the flood is over, what's his first response afterward about humanity? You're not any different. The flood is not there to change you. The flood is not there to make you different. Right? This is the reality for us. Whether it's the flood, whether it's your own list of rules that you're going to accomplish and bring to God, whether it's the Ten Commandments that follow later on, right? This is the reason why we have a faith that has two mountains. Right? Look at that Bible outline over there, right? We don't stop with one. Because that's where the flood is, right? It doesn't fix anything. And God can have a standard and he can hold you to it all he wants all day long. And the judgment will be right, but it won't change us. And so the second mountain isn't just about forgiving what you broke, but it's about changing who you are on the inside. So we finish up with Genesis today. Next 6 weeks after that, we're just going to go take that two mountain model that we have and begin to apply it in various places in our life. It is so valuable for us to recognize not only how that functions in salvation, but how that functions in our relationships. How does that bless our marriages? How does that help us when we're at work? How does that help us as we engage with government and others in the world around us? It impacts all of those things. So we'll dive into that next and kind of examine that. But for here, what we recognize is God is saying, look, I didn't bring the flood to fix you. The flood isn't going to change who you are. You remain the same individual. Right? So maybe, again, we have, in most of the time we engage with Scripture, this focus that says it's all about me. And I think God most of the time is saying, it's really not all about you. It's more about me. Right? So I think the flood story is predominantly there to reveal God to us. He could judge us any day of the week, right? Sometimes, like here, he does it in big scale. A lot of times he does it in much smaller scale. That's not the core issue. What I think God is wanting us to see is who he is. And so first of all, we have this truth that God wants us to grab, that when you sin, I suffer. I have pain in my life when you sin. But then there's a further revelation about God that is he doesn't give up on us. He had every opportunity to. It could have been right for him to say, hey, I'm not saving anybody. I'm done. This hurts too much. But God provides salvation. Right? Was it Noah that said, hey, I think I want to be a boat builder? Did that begin with him? Did Noah come to God and say, hey, God, I've seen a lot of wickedness around. I sense you might be up to something. Can we work on a deal? Right? Was Noah self-aware enough to realize that? Say, we got to figure something out here, God. No. Right? Where does it start? With God. Right, just a core foundational truth. We love, why? Because he first loved us. Right, God is always primary. Goodness doesn't come out of you. It comes out of him. And when it filters into you, then it can flow out of you. Right, you are not the fountain or the source of any of that. God always is. Right, while you were still a sinner, Christ did what? He died for you. Not while you were good, not while you were repentant. Not while you're on the right path, moving toward him. Oh, now I see you have some hope. Maybe then I'll die for you. He said, no, you're complete lost. You're a waste. You have nothing redeemable about you. I have no intention to follow me, but I'm doing this for you. Same thing here, right? There's nobody that's running after him. Noah's righteous, but he doesn't have any of those plans. God says, I am not content to destroy everybody. Yes, there's pain, and you know what? God knew that at the end there still is going to be pain. This didn't fix his pain. Right? The flood is not there to fix the pain on God's heart. He says it's still going to be there. This is how he fixes the pain on his heart. Which is why he's different than us, because we don't fix pain with pain, but God does. Right? That's the path that he chooses. But he says, I want to save. I'm going to step into my pain, into the people that bring me pain, and I'm going to save some of you because I'm not content to have it all end right there. And God goes on with this stubbornness, right, and says, I'm going to begin to limit myself. Four times, chapter 8 and chapter 9, God says this set of words, this phrase that is unique to God. And it's not a phrase that really should ever be expressed by humanity because we just can't own it. God says four times, never again. Verse 21 of chapter 8, never again will I curse the ground because of man, referring back to what happened in Genesis 3. Then in chapter 9, verse 11, never again will life be cut off by the waters of a flood, all life. And never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. Then again in verse 15, never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Never is not a great human word because we don't own all of the future and can't really say never about anything. And we also don't even fully own our own selves. Right, as much as you want to say, I'm the master of all of my own destiny and choices, we end up making a lot of choices that we really wish we hadn't. And we maybe said never about before and we don't follow through on. Never is not a good fit for us. Usually it just points out our faithlessness. Never is a word, though, that God can use, and it's a powerful word. It's a word that says, hey, things are different now. And they're not going to be the same. God says never again about a flood, not because the flood was wrong. Right? This is not a learning experience for God where he said, hey, maybe the flood's going to fix things. And at the end, he examines it again and says, wow, I guess it didn't work. I learned in this experience, and now I'm not going to do it the same way. Right? Just like we learn by touching hot stoves, etc., all these other learning experiences we have in our own lives. That's not what God is doing. God fully knew what would happen all the way through. God doesn't learn. He has that knowledge ahead of time. Right? This is God teaching us by choosing to limit his free choices. God has a right to judge our rebellion. He has a free right to do that. Right? But here is God saying, I will limit the freedom that I rightly possess. I will limit the options that are available to me and focus in on this option in front of me. So here is God limiting his options and saying, I'm not choosing options of widespread judgment and destruction anymore because I'm choosing to focus on mercy. All right, so here is the message that God is bringing to us. And the core of that is that God says, I'm making an intentional choice as I engage not only with Noah, but as I engage with humanity in the future of which you are a part. So make it highly personal. God says, as I'm choosing to engage in your life, Jen, I'm choosing a path of mercy always. Right, Brian, my work in your life is always bent toward mercy. It's where it's going to be. This is the choice God is making. No one forces him into it. He doesn't learn his way into it. He says, I have freedom to go any direction I want, and I choose mercy. And to let that resonate in our hearts, he says, let me give you some way that you can viscerally and personally experience and connect to that. And so he grants that gift of rainbow, right? It shows up and is connected to the flood. And is God saying, whenever you see this gift, I want you to resonate and remember that I have made a promise, right? So the two words that are really best reserved for God are never and always, because always is the flip side, right? Never is, it isn't going to happen anymore. Always is, it always will. And so we have the never again on the judgment side, but we have the always on the grace side. And God says, because of this rainbow, I have an always promise for you that I'm always looking for mercy in your life. I'm always going to bend in the direction of being merciful for you. Every decision that I make moves in that direction. And every time you see the rainbow, it's a reminder that this is true. Right? What has fascinated me about that is that rainbows are ubiquitous. Do you know what that word means? Everywhere, right? Abundant. More than we really need of them, right? They don't produce any real benefit for us other than being beautiful in the sky and God being this reminder. But if you travel to the North Pole, you can see a rainbow. If you travel out on the high seas, you can see a rainbow. If you travel to the highest mountain, you can see a rainbow. Or the lowest places on earth, you can see a rainbow. You can see them in a forest. You can see them in a desert. There is no place on the surface of this planet that rainbows do not occur. They are ubiquitous. And they are so stinking regular. This is me stepping outside of just the Bible part of things. And this is my own personal opinion, so just hear it for what it is. Rainbows are so consistent that it is my belief that since God made that promise to Noah, there has not been a 24-hour period for this planet when there hasn't been a rainbow. so that every day that humanity has walked since Noah got off that ark, God has put that reminder in the sky. Not because he desperately needs it, because he's already been that way, but as a reminder to us who do need that, that the God that we engage with is not a God of judgment. He's not a God who's trying to wipe you out. He's not a God that wants the end of you. He's a God that freely chooses to bend toward mercy. He's a God who says that when given the choice, I'm moving in the direction of mercy. That's where I want to go. This is the great revelation that comes out of this story that is etched across all of humanity. That there is a God who is moving toward mercy in your life. And there could not be better news for you. All right, so we'll flip to the last picture I have. It's the one that I chose for the front of the bulletin. How many of you have ever taken a picture of a rainbow before? If you haven't, just do it. What are you waiting for, right? They're amazing. They're beautiful, right? As we take pictures of rainbows, though, they tend to have this kind of framework around them, right? We're either maybe on a vacation somewhere, or they're kind of caught up with the clouds and just kind of poking out, or there's a beautiful hill in the background. You know, we can see the ocean underneath, or there's a waterfall. Man, you get like a double rainbow and a waterfall and then like a bunny rabbit. It's like perfect, right? You can't even get better than that. It's the best picture ever, right? To have all those things kind of knit together. So I picked this one just so that we recognize that rainbows are not just like special event, beautiful things. Right, so this is a rainbow over the intersection, or kind of right behind the intersection of 6th and Stark, which is an intersection that has nothing unique or special about it, right? It's got power lines and phone lines going through the background of the picture. You know, it's a building, it's a street, it's cars. You cannot get more ordinary, more boring, more everyday mundane than what that picture is. And I think it's so profound that it's not just in the special moments God says, I want to remind you that I'm orienting toward mercy, but in the most ordinary moments of life. In the simplest moments, where maybe you're not even picking your head up because your schedule's crazy and you're driving somewhere and stressed about traffic and everything else, God still paints the rainbow. He still says, that's my movement in your life. And yeah, there are beautiful moments that happens, but it's also in the very simple and the very ordinary that God says, I want to find you there too. And so as we turn to communion, we have the same thing, right? So much similarity. We have in communion very ordinary things. Anybody have bread in the last week? Probably more than raised their hands, if we're being honest, but that's okay. If you're going like, you know, grains or in paleo, that's fine too. Right? You know, and maybe wine, grape juice, etc. I'm not raising your hand on that one, but those are very ordinary parts of our lives, right? If somebody were to post on Instagram, I had a meal that had bread and wine in it, like no one would freak out. No one would be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. Like, it's just an ordinary part of who we are. And it's Jesus taking these very ordinary human aspects that are again, cross-cultural. Right? All cultures take in bread. All cultures take in wine or those kinds of things. And it's Jesus taking these very ordinary things and saying, I want to root this in the ordinary part of your life. And it's the same message, really, as the rainbow. You receive communion. You have a message from God that says, I am bending toward mercy in your life and not toward judgment. Right? It's that continual message again and again from God, whether it's in the rainbow or whether it's in communion. And I just want to remind you that even though the setting that we have right now contains a handsome man in a white robe, or not, and some really fancy kind of plateware and everything else up here, and it looks nice. We have the candelabra set up. We're all ready to go. The communion is not restricted to holy places like this. We have guidance if you and your small group want to celebrate communion. It's not limited just into places like this, and there is a richness when you find in your own home God bending toward mercy, And you find with your best friends God bending toward mercy. And you can find it here too, right? In the more beautiful moments, in the more ordinary moments, that everywhere you are, God has that orientation, right? You can't avoid it.